welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out. In this episode, I speak with Marce Abenhaus about a new book, or it was published in April. It's a book she edited on World War I in 1917. It's a multidisciplinary approach, looking at military issues, cultural issues, economic issues, a wide range of subjects to do with World War I. All right, well, thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Associate Professor Marce Abenhaus, editor of The Myriad Legacies of 1917, A Year of War and Revolution. Thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, it's great to have this opportunity. Thank you for having me.
How did you get into editing a book like this? And you can go as far back as you want.
Well, it's a bit of a story of serendipity, really, and an incredible amount of teamwork. So quite a few years ago, I think 2013, I had a knock on my office door at the University of Auckland, and in bounds this highly enthusiastic colleague of mine from another university further south in New Zealand, and he sort of encouraged me to consider becoming part of a war history and memory network, is what it's called, WAM for short. And they thought it would be a great idea to organize a symposium to reflect on the importance of the First World War to New Zealand and the world. And from that beginning, we got together with colleagues from all over the country, academics, museum curators, artists, and other practitioners, people interested in the war and its memory and its legacies. And we came up with this idea to hold an international symposium to bring these different perspectives into one kind of big event, which was eventually held in 2017 in Wellington, as the capital of New Zealand, at our national museum there, Te Papa. And it was a magnificent event, and we decided to focus on 1917 in large part because it was the centennial of 1917, but mostly also because in our conversations we all kind of gravitated to this year as having this fundamental importance at the time to shifting things for so many communities around the world and nations and the global diplomatic system and so forth, and the Russian revolutions and so forth, but also since. So we really wanted to reflect both on what it meant at the time and what it has meant since. And we wanted to not restrict that conversation to only one country or only one way of thinking. And so we brought these different perspectives together. And as an outcome of that symposium, which we got a large number of incredible papers from all over the world, and people came to the conference, and we attracted some incredible keynote speakers, some of the biggest names in the history of the First World War, really, and its legacies and its presence in museums and so forth. And as a result of that, we thought a collection bringing together some of these perspectives would be a great idea, and that's how we got this collection together, really.
And your studies are in what? What's your degree in?
Well, I'm a historian, so I have a PhD in the history of the First World War on the neutrality of the Netherlands, so a small country in Europe that managed to remain neutral during the war. So that was where where my initial interest in First World War came from, and in trying to complicate the way in which we think about the war, because we often prioritize stories of the belligerents, the conduct on and even the conduct of war on in Europe gets prioritized, and I'm really interested in complicating that narrative and showing that the war had global repercussions, and whether people were neutral or belligerent in the war, they were all impacted at a kind of fundamental level by it too. So that was my interest in really steering this this idea of why does 1917 matter.
And so were you interested in World War I since you were young, since you were a child? Or
Actually, no, that's a really good question, because I'm originally from the Netherlands, and so because of Dutch neutrality in World War One, most Dutch people, they do now have a sense of World War One, mainly because of all the centennial commemorations in Europe about it. But for much of recent history, at least, the war that matters for Dutch people is World War Two. Mm-hmm. And so my interest was always kind of steered to World War II as a result. But then when I went to do my PhD, that's what I wanted to work on. I wanted to work on the Netherlands and World War II. And my fabulous supervisor said, well, in order to understand World War II, you really need to understand World War I. Mm-hmm. So why not start your inquiry there and see where it goes? And so I had to write this literature review of what World War One meant for the Dutch. And in doing that, I realized there wasn't very much done on that subject, and that's how my interest steered to the First World War. Mm-hmm. So it was, again, serendipity, really.
I have to mention, this might seem a little silly, but just considering Dutch neutrality during World War One and the horrors that were going on near them, mm-hmm. and since you're in New Zealand, I think Lord of the Rings and the Hobbits and...
Yeah.
And that sort of thing, where they sort of ignored what was going on, and then they got drawn into it eventually. Yeah, sorry, that was just kind of a...
That's all right. It's the way in which neutrals and non-belligerents are almost always conceived as mm-hmm. by people. This notion that because you're not in the war, you are out of the war, you're uninterested, or you keep out of it. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like saying Syria doesn't matter to the rest of the world today. It clearly does. We watch. We are engaged. We worry. We consider what it means, or at least I do, and I'm sure I'm not alone in that. Mm-hmm. And so even though New Zealand is not at war in Syria, just like the Dutch went at war in 1914, 1918, mm-hmm. they were nevertheless deeply drawn into the dynamics of the war. They had to manage being neutral in very careful ways, and they had all sorts of ramifications for their economy, for millions of refugees. They had issues with border security, with smuggling, with keeping the relationship with the belligerents in such a way that they wouldn't go to war, because there was always a danger that one or other side would declare war or invade. Mm-hmm. And it's very similar to the United States. Just because the United States doesn't enter the war until 1917 doesn't mean that the United States and the American people weren't deeply mm-hmm. engaged with what this war meant and how this war evolved and the decision for war. And this is a chapter in the collection by Professor Michael Nyberg makes this case really beautifully. Mm-hmm. The decision for war in 1917 was underwritten by a willingness of the American people to go to war. They felt that this war now was too, they had too much invested in the outcome of it, and they were too afraid of what might happen if the Germans would win. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I think it behooves us all to think about war in this moment as mm-hmm. being a globally important phenomenon, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense.
It does. Okay, so let's talk specifically about the book. How do you break it down? How did you organize the essays and such? What's sort of the path you take?
In large part, the content of the book was kind of driven by the people that we attracted and could get to come to the symposium. So in some ways, the organization was kind of predetermined by who we managed to bring to New Zealand in 2017. But that, having said that, we also really wanted to make sure that it wasn't dominated by any one perspective or any one way of doing history. So there's some excellent military histories chapters in there. Mm-hmm. There are some extraordinary chapters on literature and culture, on commemorations and memorialization, There's some chapters on New Zealand. There's some chapters on the United States. There's one chapter on the United States. There's a chapter on India. Well, there's two chapters on India even. So we try to make it eclectic purposely in order to really bring out the global dimensions of the implications of this year of war and revolution as well.
I'm curious, in the United States, World War I caused one of the results of it was a sharp curbing of civil rights, where a lot of people who weren't of the right political persuasion or you know, cultural background were spied upon and, you know, looked at suspiciously. I'm curious if how much of that occurred in Europe and maybe other places. Did you address that in this book?
It's not a major feature of the book, but it is a really important feature of the war. And I think it has everything to do with the fact that security, and it's, again, it's about the global impact of warfare in this moment, that security became such a key feature of how states and governments thought about, you know, their ability to protect themselves. And so the fear of spies, the fear of others, dominated so many political discourses and political arguments at the time as well. So you see a greater involvement of the state in policing their people, their subjects and their citizens, in part because they fear that certain groups will rise up against them or proclaim support for the enemy or create movements that will force a country into war when the state itself wasn't ready for that. So there's so much more surveillance going on, driven by the context of global warfare and the fears of being drawn into things against their will and so forth. So it's not just, it wasn't just in the United States. It was true in the neutral Netherlands, particularly in areas close to the borders where there were actual obligations to keep an eye on foreigners who were crossing into and out of the borders, but more so about presenting an appropriate image into the world as well, so that other states wouldn't say, well, your people seem to be pro-British or pro-German, thus we think you are pro-British or pro-German and no longer neutral, and that might be a reason for us to go to war with you and so forth. So there was all this diplomatic politics going on, but also domestic concerns about domestic security.
Now, does the book reflect much of what was discussed in the actual symposium, or are there differences?
Yes, it really does. And I authored the introduction with an eye to bringing out some of the key themes that came out in the symposium. The symposium had a much broader breadth of discussions. There were some incredible papers from all sorts of perspectives that we didn't have space to include. We only had a limited amount of words that we could utilize that the publisher gave us. And so in many ways, lots of things that were really, really interesting, important, exciting, didn't get a place in the collection. But overall, we're really happy with the balance of chapters that we did end up putting in, and there's some really well-known established scholars and historians who have chapters in it, as well as some early career scholars and historians as well. So we really tried to balance it in that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you do, as you mentioned, you have a mix of countries discussed in the book, which people might be pleasantly surprised at. Were the scholars too? Was there, how much of a diversity was there among the scholars?
Oh, it was pretty diverse, I would say. I mean, but New Zealand is a long way away from most places. Even Australia is at least a 3.5-4 hour flight away. So we had this lovely mix of New Zealand scholars and artists and so forth who were there, as well as people from all over Australasia, so a lot of Australians, but Americans, Europeans, experts on various aspects on Russia, on Japan, and so forth, were there as well. So it was that was what really excited us as well, and that was the thing that we really did want to bring out in the book.
And I say this not to disparage your symposium at all, but I'm curious that, you know, this English speakers, but I imagine how much more intellectual diversity there would be if you could bring in people from different countries who didn't speak English.
Yes. And this is the big issue that's facing, I think, everyone in academia, and in fact across the world: language barriers and language divides. Language still divides, and while lots of academic discourse is conducted in English globally, it's not the only, and it's not even in some places the most important language. But yes, our symposium was dictated by the English language. But we had the foremost World War I scholar from France, Annette Becker, there. We had people who are more used to engaging in German there. We had representative of various histories of indigenous communities there. So while we conducted it in English, we did try to complicate and diversify the content of it. There was an extraordinary scholar on Latin American neutrality there. So, you know, we did. It was global in its perspectives and in its discussion.
And how much did you touch on maritime issues? That's just a particular interest of mine.
I can't remember entirely how much of the conference itself was on maritime issues. There was certainly some attention paid to the maritime. There isn't. I have to admit, I'm just re-scanning the table of contents. There isn't a singular chapter on maritime issues. It's also a particular interest of mine, particularly issues of economic blockade and the fact that the global economy was determined by what crossed the seas or under or over the seas at the time. So I agree with you. That would have been an excellent addition to the collection.
I'm also curious about the parts on India, because you don't offer, apart from Indian troops, you know, fighting for the British, I don't think, I don't consider India much when I think World War I, and I guess that's a mistake.
It's certainly a mistake. India, not only, the Indian not only committed large numbers of soldiers to this war, and they maintained the security of the Indian borders, the Middle East and so forth, in this war as well, which was really geostrategically and of great importance to the British, the sustenance and maintenance of the British Empire. But we have these two chapters in the collection, one by Professor Radhika Singer, who I think was offered one of the most original papers at the conference, and it talked about how, as the cost of war spiraled out of control, all the belligerents, and particularly the great power belligerents, had to find new sources of money and credit. And that the British Empire had been reluctant to force or to enforce war loans and so forth and war subscriptions in India. It had done so in the white dominions, but it hadn't done so in India. So she talks about how in 1917 they changed that position, and they issued a request from the Indian public for a war loan, and they got an extraordinary amount of money. I'm not going to hazard a guess, in the millions and millions of rupees. And so she talks about the context of that, what inspired people to give even small amounts of their earnings to an empire that was also suppressing and controlling and keeping them as subjects, and, you know, imperial subjects. And so she talks about the politics of that and the social and cultural implications of that. So it's a really powerful analysis of that moment. And she used some really interesting examples of how propaganda in India focused on why fighting for this war, this British war, was so essential for the Indian public as well. And then the other chapter on India is by renowned Australian military historian Professor Peter Stanley, who talks about British territorial troops who go into India in 1914 to replace the British regulars who were there, who then go off to fight the war, and their activities and behavior and agency and what they experienced in the war, but with a particular focus on 1917 itself and the shift to them also becoming more responsible for policing disruptions in India itself, and also for more fighting and on the various military fronts in India.
Yeah, it's interesting when a country that has sort of an empire or territories goes through a long and expensive war, or relatively long, more than a year. You know, I think you see stresses where they have their, you know, territories. Whereas it seems like it was the opposite with India, where there wasn't a threat of revolution, it was more support.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question in and of itself, because the chapter by J. Winter, Professor J. Winter, early on in the war, marks 1917 as this key shift, I mean, in large part because of the Russian revolutions, but also because there are so many popular responses to war, that increasingly anti-war agitation from within so many countries, belligerent and neutral countries for that matter, in that time. And so I want to make it seem like all Indians supported this war at all times. And certainly key elites in India, people associated with Mahatma Gandhi and so forth, and with anarchist and some socialist groups, and certainly some nationalist revolutionaries who saw an opportunity in the war to mobilize Indians against empire as a way of creating a political momentum to either gaining independence or certainly gaining more, well, in Ireland it was called home rule, to create a sort of Indian home rule movement. So that depending on how radical the person or the group was, they had some kind of impact on extricating, moving themselves out of the yoke of British imperial control. And so 1917, I think, quite clearly was one of these moments that the shift to anti-imperial politics became far more pronounced at the global level as well. So decolonization processes really come to a fore after World War II, but many of them were augmented by this war experience. I guess it's sometimes you could also relate it to the fact, so in French Africa and in French-controlled Indochina, so Vietnam and things, similar things were happening. And in those cases, it was very much about claiming citizenship. So we Senegalese, we Vietnamese are fighting for France. That makes us French citizens, and therefore we should have rights to political power. So this, of course, frightened these imperial powers as well. They couldn't both fight a war with these, you know, these other empires, the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians, and protect security of the empire from within. And that explains, again, in some way, why there was so much control of people. So it was both about mobilizing people for war in a way that aided the war effort and managing the political ambitions of those groups at the same time so that they wouldn't collapse from within. And of course, in Russia and in Austria-Hungary and in Germany, they did collapse from within, and those empires end up no longer existing after 1917-18, mm-hmm. including the Ottoman Empire, too, in that.
Okay. Were there other significant issues discussed in the book that we haven't touched on yet that you'd like to mention?
Oh, let me think. Let me just have a look. Yes, one of the there's two things, I think. One is the three chapters we have on New Zealand, which, as you know, is this very small country, was part of the British Empire, mm-hmm. and would seem to have, well, certainly had a very important war history for itself. So New Zealanders see World War One as this key moment that changed the way New Zealanders thought of themselves, thought of their role in the empire, and so forth. And so we have these three chapters that all kind of investigate some part of that New Zealand war story, but very much we've used it as a way to explain how important 1917 was as a global reality through these chapters as well. So we have a chapter on how the indigenous people of New Zealand, the Māori, mobilized for war in part as a way to gain more civil rights and political representation in New Zealand politics and in New Zealand society, mm-hmm. and in the empire more at large. We also have a chapter by our foremost military historian, Professor Glenn Harper, on New Zealand's involvement in the various battles in Europe and the Middle East in 1917, and he categorizes 1970 as a catastrophic year for New Zealand because it lost more soldiers than any other moment in the war, and what that meant for the what military consequences there were of that. And then we have another chapter by Dr. Jock Phillips, who talks about how the Battle of Passchendaele, for example, was commemorated in New Zealand at the time and in its immediate aftermath and up to right up to today, and how we see these changes in the way people consider and engage with this particular battle in New Zealand's history. So they really kind of bring out some of the key things that affected other societies around the world, including the United States. But we really liked the fact that we could focus on this New Zealand example of that. And then the other key addition to the book, I think, is this chapter by an early career historian, Thomas Schmutz, who's from Switzerland. And he's written a chapter on the Caucasus front in between Russia and the Ottoman Empire during the war. And he really shows and highlights and reminds us that it is in this area, which is today still a hugely important geostrategic political area, right, in today's world. Well, it was in that world as well. And the changes, the fact that when Russia, the Russian revolutions begin and Russia removes itself as a military force in that region, how that had an extraordinary impact on the Ottoman Empire and its own ambitions for a Turkish empire, and its impact on things like the Armenian Genocide and other things that were evolving still at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really powerful and important reminder that we shouldn't blink our attention only on, you know, Europe or only on certain military fronts, that the Caucasus was just as important. And 1917 was a key moment in that front as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's every time I hear about, you know, here the Caucasus, I just think of mountains and just bloody, bloody, vicious fighting.
Yeah. It was, and there was a vast amount of violence towards civilians and pogroms and all sorts of things on both sides that, and in part we can explain that because the stakes from the perspective of the empires that were fighting there, of the peoples who were fighting there, were so high. And so, yeah, it was, and so Thomas Schmutz reminds us how key this is, and we must, when we think about the war, in general, but certainly about 1917 in specifics, this is a key part of that story.
I know as editor, you might not be completely familiar with what the presenters used for their research, but did you get an idea of that any of them found resources that were new or perhaps not as well known by past World War One historians?
Well, that's a harder question for me to answer. Mm-hmm. We certainly had as a guiding principle that we didn't want to present perspectives that were already well established and known. Mm-hmm. We really wanted the collection to focus on implications and perspectives that were new or at least were developed in new ways. And so all the chapters are asking key questions and developing the narratives and the stories in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. In terms of the new materials, I'm certain most of the chapters are based also on new research as such. Mm-hmm. But the art of history is not just in the newness of the sources, it's also in the newness of the perspectives. It's a bit of both. The other thing to say is that there are two chapters in the collection that were written by directors and museum curators, and they talked about how 1917 has become this pivotal year in the way in which they present the importance of this war to the public. Mm-hmm. That comes into the museum. So one chapter is by Piet Gielens, who's the director of the In Flanders Fields Museum in Ypres. And it's really, and he shows how this museum has become a sort of, has become a place for the world to think about war as an interface. But so Flanders is a global space because so many people, communities, families were impacted by what happened in the war, but also in 1917 in that region. Mm-hmm. The chapter does a beautiful job of showing how they do that, how they make this war everyone's war, and a moment to reflect on that. And Horst Picken, who is a curator at the Military History Museum in Dresden in Germany, does a similar kind of thing, except he looks at it more broadly, how Germans and German museums and institutions have commemorated 1917 as a pivotal year in German history. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, those two things are quite important, and they're really important new perspectives that get integrated into why does 1917 matter.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to connect the words, bring together the words commemorated and German mm-hmm. in relation to World War One, considering they lost and what happened to them. Do they commemorate it, or was that just?
Yes, but I mean you're right. It is a difference in how victors commemorate and how others, you know, so I'm not enough of an expert to be able to develop this well enough, I think, but in many ways, well, what Gorsh Pekin shows in his chapter is that the memory of the war has had a powerful influence on how Germans consider war more generally. Hmm. And it certainly came as a course of 1920s and 30s became part of the ways in which the Nazi regime profiled war. And so after World War II, after the fall of the Nazi regime in West Germany, certainly the way in which war was presented in public was almost like it was ignored, and that was as true for World War One as it was of World War Two. And so it's taken generations of time, you know, several generations for there to be a re-engagement with what is war, what does it mean for Germans in World War One and in its aftermath. And so it's, I think it's a really quite a difficult question. I mean, it's a difficult question for all who work in the area. So how do you represent violence? How do you take care with the fact there is so much grief and attached to these subjects? How do you make sure that you don't inadvertently even promote certain messages in the way you communicate the history of extreme violence, of military violence, of victory and of defeat? Mm-hmm. And the Germans, and certainly the Military Museum in Dresden, has done so much to do this with an eye to being careful with the costs of war. So, you know, you have to take your hat off at them, because it's quite easy to turn war into something to celebrate because it created a nation, for example, or it involved heroic acts by soldiers and so forth. Yeah. And to then also to counter that with, well, there were immense costs to those creations of nations, and there were immense costs to those heroic acts on all sorts of levels. That's a really important thing to do, and it's a very hard thing to do as well.
Yeah. This is more an observation than a question, but your comment about Germany, it makes me wonder how the difference between how West Germans and East Germans celebrated or how they approached remembrance of the two world wars before unification, you know, when they were divided. I'm just, that'd be an interesting thing to look into.
Yeah, it will have everything to do with the ideologies that underpinned those two regimes. So Soviet regime in the GDR and East Germany will have certainly have portrayed both wars as an outcome of imperial capitalist powers and the willingness to go to war and kill off workers and ordinary people for the needs of the elites. Mm-hmm. And in West Germany, it was a slightly more nuanced, but also a very difficult and often just silenced subject for many decades, just because it was too difficult to deal with in a way that could adequately meet the needs of the political elite and the needs of the people. So, it's a fascinating subject. I don't know enough about it, but there is quite a bit of literature written on that.
Yeah. So what part of either the symposium or editing this book was most enjoyable for you?
Oh, absolutely working with a great team of people. So not just my co-editors who come from a variety of backgrounds. Kingsley Baird, who's from Massey University and is an artist and an academic, is a professor of and has done some extraordinary work of his own in reflection on war in 1917. And Gail Romano, who's a colleague of mine here in Auckland, who works at the Auckland War Memorial Museum and is a curator of music exhibitions. And then Neil Atkinson, who is a colleague of mine at the New Zealand Ministry of Culture and Heritage and has been working with the New Zealand government's what they call WW100, so the centennial celebrations and commemorations of this war. But working with these amazing people and then getting to engage with this incredible scholarship and these incredible scholars was really the most rewarding part for me in the whole process.
Mm-hmm. And again, considering both the symposium and the book, what did you learn that was most surprising?
I don't know. I think it was Einstein who said something along the lines is the more I know, the less I know. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, you know, I went into this thinking 1917 is really important and it isn't being treated enough as a global phenomenon. The war itself needs to be globalized. But then coming across all these ways in which the major events of that year impacted and had reverberations across communities and ways of thinking, and that was really quite profound and has made me realize how important it is to keep, you know, to remind ourselves that there's always more to discover, almost more to ask, and almost always more to investigate. So the story is far from complete.
Mm-hmm. What would you say was among the researchers, was there a particular issue that you noticed that was difficult for people to come to a conclusion on? Is there an issue about the war, and especially 1917, that you noticed just not enough information or research or something?
Well, from my perspective, this is more a larger issue dealing with the history of World War One in general. It is still way too Eurocentric, I think, in the way it is portrayed. It was the war in Europe is still often the way in which people present and historicize and talk about this war. And it is true, the war in Europe, that's where the majority of the war fronts were. But there was such an incredible global involvement in that war. The entire global economy fed that war. And there were so many military war fronts, military violence outside of Europe that is often neglected. So the fronts in Africa, the millions of Africans who died as couriers, as soldiers, as civilians, mm-hmm. in this war is often neglected. The starvation and the food issues, the lack of food due to the military situations and due to blockades and due to the interruptions of the global economy as caused by the war in the Middle East, in Africa, and around the world don't get enough attention, if you ask me. So while there's this massive literature on did Germans starve in the war and how did Austro-Hungarians and Germans and Russians deal with an inability to for the states to ration effectively and distribute their resources effectively across their populations, and this explains in some part the outbreak of the revolutions there in 1917 and 18 and so forth, there isn't enough attention to the fact that, you know, millions of people in the Middle East also starved during this war, as did hundreds of thousands of African people, millions of Africans as well, and that needs, I think that needs correcting, that needs globalizing at the very least, not to sell the suffering and the experiences in Europe, which were significant and extremely important, obviously. It's about expanding those and showing that it wasn't just Europe or Europeans that suffered intensely and immensely as a result of this conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a simple analogy I see is, you know, the big rock dropped in a pond, you know, center would have been Europe, but then the ripples just went, it sounds like, just went across the world.
Yeah, that's a nice analogy, I think.
And I wonder how many of the people who were affected but not in the war, you know, their opinions, you know, is it more like, oh, what's going, you know, these crazy Europeans, or is it just like things happen and most people don't understand why, but, you know, looking at the broad picture, you know, it's because of the war affecting everything.
Both those things are correct. I think on the one hand, there was, there was food security issues in Latin America, serious ones that caused serious suffering among people in South America across the war. And if you were to have asked one of those people why is there a shortage of whatnot, or why are we not able to feed ourselves properly, or why is not enough jobs around, then their answer would have been the war. That would have been an explanation enough, because they all understood, you know, the fact that they sold their goods on into the international economy had an impact on them. How much they could import and export and so forth. And there was it also had enormous benefits for other countries, Japan and the United States. Their global power expanded phenomenally as a result of the removal of many European merchants and agents in the trading economies of the Asia-Pacific and American regions, for example. So it had positive impacts on some. But I'm always struck by the fact that there is a very persuasive argument, I think, about how Chinese people and how Japanese people viewed this war in Europe. And given the pressures in the 19th century for these societies to westernize, to be like Europeans or to be like Westerners in order to be able to compete effectively in the international environment, mm-hmm. whether economically or diplomatically. And this was always sold as a civilizing development. There is this very strong tone in, I think, in their propaganda around the war to say, well, you know, these Europeans aren't so civilized after all, are they? They're slaughtering each other completely. And there isn't very much civilized about that. So why are we, you know, there was this help to retake some of the we're not Europeans sort of thing in their political discourses and cultural identities as well. So it had really important legacies for how people thought about who they were and what values a certain culture or nation had embraced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you were explaining some of this, it made me think that one of the limitations that a country has when it goes to war is how long can it keep an army in the field? How long mm-hmm. can they sustain them? And then thinking about World War One, it seems like it's about it's the time in history when you have an industrial infrastructure that can feed mm-hmm. a battlefield and the armies in them with people and supplies and food from a much wider range, like you say, Latin America, you know, the Middle East. There's supplies coming in from all over, and it seems like World War One could be conducted simply because the European powers could access so much more resources to keep a huge mm-hmm. army.
I think you're right. The tragedy, one of the tragedies, there were many, many tragedies in this era of warfare, but the tragedy of total industrial warfare mm-hmm. is that it made effectively the global economy a kind of agent of war. Mm-hmm. And until that economy exhausted itself in the sense of that there were so many communities that were no longer able to function properly or stably, until that occurred, the war, I think, well, that would be my explanation, and a lot of historians who disagree with this explanation, it's mm-hmm. probably too materialistic for them, but I know, I always think that it is in the supply, it's that the military, industrial military complex, we would call it today, you know, mm-hmm. it's in sustaining that, as long as that's sustainable, the war will continue. As soon as that starts to have serious impacts on people's lives and on communities, mm-hmm. that we see the breakdown of it, of the war itself. So this war was sustained by the global economy, and that meant every single part of that economy, and it was an industrial economy and a global economy by 1914, mm-hmm. That was key, I think.
Yeah, because the parts of the global economy didn't even have to be tied into militaries to begin with. But once the war started,
they just had to. They, of course, it is also true that in 1914, the strongest, biggest, and most viable economies, national or imperial economies, were the very countries, aside from the United States and the United States, really, were the very countries that go to war in 1914, including Japan. Mm-hmm. And it's, I always say, it's the fact that the United States managed to sustain its neutrality for so long meant that it could gain so much by supplying it increased its wealth. Adam Tooze wrote a wonderful book about this. It increased its wealth exponentially because it could supply the war without having to, a great profit to its own well-being and economy without suffering any of the serious consequences of that war materially, at least not until it goes to war. So the economic element of this story is so key to explaining both the military elements and aspects of this story. They're integrated, and that deserves more attention, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would pause.
This, of course, play a key role in that, the maritime conduct of the war, the trade, the blockades, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I would posit that even the United States at this time had started to become an empire with their the possessions they had won from Spain, and by this time, you know, up until World War I, the U.S. Navy had really started to reluctantly think about how do we defend these possessions across the ocean.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely true. The United States, after 1898, becomes a global imperial power. It was, of course, already an imperial power as it conquered all of the North American continent in the previous century, but becomes a global one, a blue water empire, you could call it, like the British, smaller number of holdings, but still vitally important to sustaining trade networks, people networks, power networks. Mm-hmm. I always think the opening of the Panama Canal in 1914, just after the war is declared, is this key moment that signals the rise of American power. Mm-hmm. Panama Canal makes American economic affairs so much easier and global. Mm-hmm. It speeds up everything. And the fact that it occurs at the same time is this really key interface of circumstances. It kind of leads to an outcome that nobody at the time could have imagined possible, but certainly with hindsight we can see the origins of American superpower status in those moments.
Mm-hmm. Certainly California, I've been told, reaped great benefits from supplying the war, agriculturally and in other ways.
Yeah, and the fact that it could now do so by shipping all those things through the Panama Canal rather than having to truck them across by rail or to go right round the bottom of Latin America. That's a really key shift.
Mm-hmm. So was there anything that you learned that had an emotional impact on you, either positively or negatively?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I always get, one of the things is I always think about how important people networks are in anything that's created. So the fact that at the symposium I got to reconnect with old friends, with colleagues, meet new ones, and have conversations with people who know what you're saying because they're working on similar things or in similar themes, and who can inspire you to think of things differently or to bring up some perspective you never thought of. And not just the collegiality, but the friendships that are wrought in those moments. That to me is I think always a incredibly pleasant side effect of all this. I'm so fortunate to work in a field where there's so many amazing people and amazing ideas, people with amazing ideas and amazing, but that they're also just really fabulous people in and of themselves. So that would be the thing that I would say would be most emotional. I think the second thing to say would be that I'm always still struck by how topical these events are for all sorts of people and communities today. I read an article that Akira Irie wrote this year or last year in which he called the First World War ancient history, as if it was now so long ago that it no longer has an impact on the way things are today. And I couldn't disagree with him more. And kind of this experience of this symposium and working on this collection really reiterated that to me, that the reverberations of this violent global event, you know, stretched across more than 100 years now to today and still affects peoples because their families were affected, but it also still affects global power and events all around the world. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a you know, those things, you know, I think about a lot, and they have a more than just as an intellectual exercise. They matter.
Mm-hmm. So I know, so the book was published in April, correct?
Yeah.
So apart from advancing World War I research, what do you hope, or what has the book been able to do beyond that?
Well, it's drawn together people from different disciplines to talk about war, which I think is significant. It's one moment in this very large centennial celebrations and commemorations that have been going on around the world in various ways for the last 4 years, and then it will be drawing to a close next year with a whole series of other events that are occurring about the Treaty of Versailles and things like that, and the creation of the League of Nations and things like that. So it has a place in that centennial discourse. I think for me also, I think it's been a moment for New Zealand society and New Zealanders to well, at least for the scholarly community and the museum community, and artists and so forth who work on war, to come together and reflect just for a moment collectively, mm-hmm. and across disciplines and cross, it's more than just disciplines, across different ways of thinking, cultural and other ways of thinking about war. So in those ways, it's been a really, you know, it's not just an academic book. It's not just a thing that came out of a bunch of people who with expertise who came together to discuss a topic that they all have some relationship to. It's done more than that. So, you know, it's reflecting a societal question, I think.
Now, I've been told that World War I, for Australians, it's considered the war that made them a nation. It's sort of like, mm-hmm. yes, they existed before, but that gave them their identity. Would you say the same for New Zealand at all, or what's the approach there?
Well, that depends on who you ask, but in terms of foundation myths, it certainly is considered true for New Zealand that New Zealand, while it existed as a kind of a sense of community before the war, as part of the British Empire, yes, but with its own kind of national identity or really forming, that the experience of war and certainly its involvement in the Anzac invasion of Gallipoli in 1915, that those and it's the huge losses of life in Gallipoli, but also on the Western Front and in the Middle East through the war, mm-hmm. Kind of created a sense of a national experience that we can flag out the creation of New Zealand as a sense of community. But it's a myth, and as with all nation building myths, it has problematic sides to it. But it is a very powerful myth nevertheless here in New Zealand, yes. So it's like Australia in that sense.
Were there any difficulties in finishing the book or getting it published? It seems like it was a smooth process.
That was a very smooth process, and in many ways, Paul Grave Macmillan, who published it, they're such professionals at this. You know, the process gets going, it's just a case of keeping people to time, making sure everybody knows what they're doing, and you know, there would be occasional, you know, with all things, you have a few niggles here and there, but as long as you keep at it, it gets done. So, so it was just a case of working hard through it.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask you quickly, your latest writing project, I said I wanted to speak to you some other time about it. Can you mention it quickly here?
Yeah, so I've just finished another book, which is called The Hague Conferences and International Politics between 1898 and 1915, which is coming out this month with Bloomsbury Publishing. And it's really about how people before the First World War already considered the restriction and restraint on war as an important part of how they thought the international environment should work. So we often hear that that with the League of Nations, people became more more committed to, and because of World War I, they became more committed to restricting and restraining warfare. And this book kind of argues that that wasn't a result of World War I itself. World War I augmented those ideas, but they preceded that war, and they're closely connected to the Hague Peace Conferences of 1898 and 1907. And that's what the book is about. How did people in that time period before the war engage with and politically mobilize themselves behind ideas of peace and arbitration, international law, restricting warfare, and so forth?
So where can people find the book, and can they follow your thoughts and work online anywhere?
Yeah, they can. So the Married Legacies of 1917 book is available through most online bookshops. So, and it's also available through the publisher's website. So that's paulgrove.com. They've got it clearly on there. And aside from that, if you can follow me online, I'm on Twitter at MarriageUp, but I'm a difficult name to spell. So, you know, just Google me and you'll find me in various online forums doing my thing.
Can you spell the Twitter handle?
Yeah, so it's MarriageUb, effectively, MarriageUp.
Okay. That's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts or words?
No, you know, this is a joy to be part of, and I'm very pleased with the end product, and I hope others are too.
All right. Well, thank you for speaking with me.
No, it's a great pleasure.
This podcast has been presented by War Scholar. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to visit warscholar.org or militaryhistorypodcast.com for more great interviews and military history information. Your visits help support this podcast. One of the best ways to provide feedback for this podcast is to rate me on iTunes. Please give me a good rating if you liked it, or feel free to give me a bad rating if you didn't. I'll use that feedback to make this a better podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar. That's Chris without an H. C-R-I-S. On Facebook under War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, and on Twitter under War Scholar. Thank you, and I hope you return to this podcast for more great military history.